where everybody else is trying to take hands out of the stroke. I'm like, wait a minute. When I was a kid and watched, say, Hubert Green or Raymond Floyd or Seve Ballesteros, you complimented them by saying, this guy has great hands. He's got the greatest feeling, greatest touch. And I just see so many instructors that are going, we got to take that little muscles out of the swing. I'm like, no, you got to enhance that and practice that and love that. It's incredible.
I'm here bright and early in Philadelphia, about to go off and play the Golfers Journal event at Lanark.
Nice.
If you're familiar with the Philly golf area, Lanark sort of flies under the radar. I grew up at Rolling Green, which you probably visited.
We covered the women's.
I was going to say that would have been 2013. Yeah, so you would have done the women's am there.
We were there in 15.
Okay.
I think it was.
With our buddy Shane Bacon, Golfers Journal contributor.
Correct.
So that's where I grew up playing and caddying, but Lanark is right down the street, just redone by Brian Schneider.
It's great.
Tom Doak's fame. And it is. It's another little hidden gem, a little closer to town. Really, really fun place. Super, super fun hang. So we're going to have a great time out there today. But first, the chance to talk with Brad Faxon. So welcome to the Golfers Journal podcast, everybody, presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. Brad, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. I know you got a busy schedule. What a busy day in golf as well, coming right off our national championship. And it was pretty special. Where were you enjoying it? Being in New England, you're New Englander yourself, coming to us from, you're in Rhode Island right now?
I am in Rhode Island, where I grew up, the town of Barrington, where I grew up as a young kid, went to all my schooling here, caddied, and then later played at Rhode Island Country Club, which is a nice little Donald Ross gem on Narragansett Bay. But I was in Brookline the whole week. I've been doing some television for Sky Sports and was there. I got there on Monday, walked the golf course, had played in Brookline a number of times in the U.S. Amateur, U.S. Open in 1988, being a local
guy. Were you
guy,
in the 2013 U.S. Amateur like everybody else, Brad?
I was in the 1982 U.S. Amateur.
Okay.
But no, that was pretty cool. What did they have? 22 different guys that played in that U.S. Amateur, including the champion and the runner-up. Yeah, it was pretty impressive. Yeah, really
it was.
Cool.
Hey, Rhode Island Country Club, I'm supposed to go up there. Do you ever... a cool logo, isn't it? Like a rat or something, or is that a different
club? That's everybody's trying to use multiple logos on their clubs now, and you know, we kind of had this emblem with a lighthouse, and inside of that emblem was a rat called the muskrat, and they've just taken that muskrat out, and now that's one of the alternative logos. Wanamoisit, which is another great course down the street here, has a new one with a goat on it. That was in their crest. They had four different things in their crest. They took the goat out, and everybody likes that because that goat has become a popular term.
Indeed. But I like the muskrat. My buddy had it on his bag. Cool. I'm like, that's cool. That's different. Well, hey, there's so much we can talk about today. I know you've been getting a lot of questions about your work with Rory, and we certainly want to talk about that. But just, you know, and being at the country club all week and getting to walk around and being there, practice rounds and seeing it all, why did it give us such a great Open, do you think? You know, why do these golden age courses give us typically, I mean, this was not every one of them gives us a great tournament, but the country club certainly did. Why do you think that was the case?
There's a few reasons, in my opinion. First of all, variety. There were so many different types of holes. I think the balance of really long par fours, say back to back on 3 and 4, hole like 15, 10, spectacular hole, what was a par 5 in the previous Open in 88. You had two great short holes, short fours on each 9, the 5th and the 17th. And then you had one par 5 that was pretty reachable and one that wasn't. I just think the history there, the country club, one of the original, we all know that, one of the original 5 founding clubs. I think the ability they have to make a composite course with the other extra 9 holes I think the work Gil Hance has done, we all know he's become the new, I'm sure he doesn't like that phrase, open doctor. But, you know, there were holes that were really narrow that looked like a U.S. Open hole, like that 15th hole. Then there were some wide open holes, like number four, that semi-blind shot. You had a lot of variety of either tee shots that were blind, second shots that were semi-blind, depending on where you placed the ball. I mean, rough that was, definitely a deterrent, but certainly playable most of the time. And then, you know, like you saw McIlroy with the second shot on the third hole on the second round on Friday, you never thought he might get out of that fescue when he hit that wayward shot. So I just think it had everything. And Tom, I've never been to a U.S. Open, or I've never watched a U.S. Open where I've never heard one complaint about anything to do with the golf course, the setup, the condition. It never went over the edge. Certainly wasn't the longest course we've ever seen at 71 or 7,200 yards. It was universally acclaimed by every single player and pundit. And, you know, if you watch Twitter like we all do, I think everybody's calling for this to get in that rotation, whatever that rotation is.
Very good point. I mean, it does seem like a rite of passage is playing armchair quarterback for the U.S. Open, right? Is to sit there and judge it and find out something to complain about to the USGA. At USGA, you did this, you know, it's just they get a hard time. And this, you're right. I didn't think about that. This is the first Open where I think it's just been universal applause from the conditions to I wonder, you know, we have a new head of things with Mike Wand, and I don't know what impact that has. But yeah, it's pretty nice. The USGA must be beside themselves this morning, I guess.
They have to be. I don't think Michael Wand would have anything to do with the golf course setup there. He's too new. He's not really a golf guy. Right. Thomas Pagel and his team of guys did an incredible job. I think Mike Davis, you know, he was kind of the maestro behind it for so many years. And I don't think this was overthought, this setup. You know, it was like, okay, we don't have to change, you know, a long par four into a drivable par four and trick people. They had a beautiful blend of par threes, the second and the sixth, kind of uphill with some kind of quirky green on the sixth, and just a tough hole on two uphill. And then you had that beautiful little 11th hole where guys could hit a wedge, played at 108 yards yesterday, 140 the day before. And you saw players make bogey there, and not a lot of guys make it too. It played over par for one of the shortest holes in championship history. It's just everything about it was great. And you know, when you have that quality of a leaderboard, a guy that's been in contention a lot, like Matthew Fitzpatrick, you have the world's number one, you have Rory McIlroy, you know, everybody's on his back. And then another heir to the throne there in Will Zalatoris, and that fantastic finish, the shot that he hit, where I didn't think he could get it on the green. It was spectacular.
Yeah, it really was. Speaking of Rory, indeed. I mean, he goes into this week, doesn't shy from the spotlight, winning in Canada, and you know, with everything that's going on in golf, Rory is carrying, it seems, in my imagination at least, I don't know what he's thinking, but you know, is carrying a little extra weight perhaps. You did a great job on the broadcast talking, I know you're on Sky, but on the American broadcast as well, talking about some of your work with Rory. Walk us through that. What's it like when Rory McIlroy calls you up, or somebody calls you up and says, hey, you want to take a look at my stroke or my putting?
It's really an honor. I mean, here's a guy that's going to be one of the best players in the history of the game. Certainly the most popular player now after Tiger Woods, that's currently on the PGA Tour. He worldwide recognition, respected by everyone, from the fans, his peers, you know, a guy that, it's so unlikely how far he can hit this golf ball. He's finished in the top 10 of all three of the majors so far this year, maybe top five. And he's, you know, and people say he's an underachiever. I mean, he had an incredible week again, maybe a couple mistakes. If he could play that third hole over again twice, maybe it's a different ending. But he's putting beautifully. And when I was asked to help him, you know, a little over four years ago, when I got the phone call, I called his longtime coach and I said, how do you work best with him? And he said, look, the best way to work with Rory is away from tournaments. Give him an idea or two, let him figure out how he wants to do it. And then you don't have to do much. And I mean, that's simplifying it a little bit, but I mean, he's as talented and gifted a player as there are. And you know, I see this huge trend with players and teams of players like Fitzpatrick has. And then Rory's the other way. He's alone on a mountain, doesn't want all that extra thought while he's out there playing. And every player is a little bit different. So I think I get a lot of credit when he putts great, and you get blamed when he doesn't putt well, but it's really just the talent of Rory McIlroy. It has very little to do with what I've told him.
He did putt great. If you would have told me in the beginning of the week that he was going to putt like that, I would have taken all the chips. They would have all gone in on McIlroy, especially the way he was, you know, hitting the ball in Canada. I've never seen a putt like that. That streak of one putts, you know, from Saturday into Sunday was absolutely insane. When you are working with him, you know, away from tournaments, what are some of the things, you know, you'd said on the broadcast that when you work together, you don't do a lot. You spend a lot of time talking. What are you talking to Rory about?
I would say more like situations than it is mechanics. I mean, not that we haven't ever talked to mechanics. There are certain tendencies that every player has. We've kind of isolated Rory down to a couple little tendencies, simple thoughts that he can not only think about, but he can diagnose himself. We're not using big words. I'm not trying to be a biomechanist or a anatomy and physiologist. There's a psyche to this. And I learned so much from playing a long time and asking the best players and putters in the world their thoughts. And, you know, we talk about things like, what do you do for a pre-shot routine? How does that work? How do you evaluate a putt? I see so many people that try to classify putt as something important or difficult or left to right versus right to left, where I just, let's make everything its own shot, its own putt. If you have the right speed and right line, they're always going to be pretty close to going in, and just kind of doing that over and over and over again. I know that's such a cliche. And we have little games that we like to do when we warm up. And I think there's a big difference between, when you're in competition, between practicing your stroke and then warming up to play golf. And I think that's worth explaining, because you see a lot of players of today when they go out there and they'll have some kind of training aids, devices out there, mirrors or strings or gates to putt through. I think in my opinion, when players play their best, they're more casual, they're more vague, they're not too specific about what they do. And, you know, watch a couple long putts roll, then hit a few short putts at different speeds. I like to do that. Go through your routine a little bit on your practice warm up before you go out to play, so that the first putt you have in the first hole, you've done it a couple times, and it's pretty easy. It's pretty simple. And look, if Rory didn't have good mechanics, we would have had to work on mechanics, but I think his mechanics were pretty good when we met, and it was just kind of letting them come out.
You said working on some of Rory's tendencies. What would some of those be, perhaps?
They're small, they're slight. When I first met him, sometimes the putter would go a little bit outside or a little bit too straight back. Maybe, you know, the putter should be on a little bit of an arc, and that depends on lie angle, how far from the ball you are, a couple other parts of it, the putter that you use. And his right arm sometimes got a little high, a little away from his body. And he just likes this little key of his right arm, almost his elbow, like touching the edge of his shirt on the right side.
Yeah.
That's one key. We talk about setup. So when you look at somebody face on, if you look at the logo on his hat or his nose, the placket on his shirt and the zipper, that they're pretty balanced and straight up and down. Every once in a while, he gets, you know, tilted a little more to the right, and that gets the putter more in to out than it should be. And that causes the face to close a little quickly. But stuff like that, we talk a little bit about grip pressure at times, not standing over the ball too long, keeping it a sport, keeping it athletic. And you know, every part of this game now is getting diagnosed, isn't it? It's getting broken down with great cameras that you can find on your cell phones. You can slow motion everything. You got apps on every device you have. You can really, really get intrigued by all the information out there. But when it comes to game time, I don't think anybody's better than Rory and throwing all that stuff out and just playing golf.
Indeed. And I heard also some mention of whether it was Rory or you talking about, you know, putting, not so worried about making it, right? Can you describe, can you explain that a little bit, where, what that means?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had a quote years ago that I said, I like to putt where I don't care if I miss. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the best putters, if you go for a week, and Rory led strokes gained putting at the US Open, it's a remarkable number, 7 or 8 strokes gained on his putter. But still, he didn't make every putt. You know, you've got to putt like with the attitude that you've already made it, or that it doesn't matter if you miss, because that is a way, and to me, that it helps to free you up. It helps to not get you, maybe would you'd say result oriented, where when people make every putt dire, I think that can cause issues. And look at even Will Zalatoris, who has putted fabulously and has a funny looking stroke when it gets inside about 3 or 4 feet. You kind of want to watch it and see what he does, but statistically he's perfect from inside 3 feet on the PGA Tour this year. And that's a big sample size of putts, not a small. And he was again, another top 10 putter in 2 majors in a row. So you don't have to be perfect. I do things with players like, from 5 feet, I make them aim way to the right and way to the left and see if they can manipulate their stroke. Can you shift your path, or can you manipulate your club face to use eye-hand coordination in your practice? Where everybody else is trying to take hands out of the stroke, I'm like, wait a minute. When I was a kid and watched, say, Hubert Green or Raymond Floyd or Seve Ballesteros, you complimented them by saying, this guy has great hands. He's got the greatest feel and greatest touch. And I just see so many instructors that are going, we got to take that little muscles out of the swing. I'm like, no, you got to enhance that and practice that and love that. It's incredible.
Wow. I love that. That's exciting to me because I want to be, I grew up a little more of a handsy. I kind of transitioned, you know, I grew up around in the bullseye generation, and not to date myself, but And now I'm in a all shoulders kind of putting world, and I'd like a little pop in my stroke, and I'm glad to hear that that's okay.
It's really okay, and I would say some of the practice that we've done is, hey, let's see, can you get good at practicing? Like I said, aiming a little left or aiming a little right. Can you hit a putt off the toe, off the heel? Can you do it with one eye closed, then the other eye closed? Can you make a putt with a hook stroke or with a slice stroke, hit it high on the face, low on the face, and just kind of what I call this term, explore the boundaries, you know, because every putt doesn't have to be hit in the middle of the face to be a good putt or to be a putt that goes in. And that's something that I would profess that, like, we don't do that enough. We're always on a line. We're always with a mirror. We're always through a gate. And always trying to be perfect. And I find when a lot of players feel like they're almost playing horse, like shooting baskets horse with their putter, you know, when you hit in different speeds or different lines on breaking putts, that it gets more fun. It opens up that, you know, you can simplify and say the brain's left and right or creative and analytical. And I think opening that right side of the brain so you can be more artistic is a way that a lot of players have had success. And you listen to players after they've shot a great round. Almost all of them say, "That was a great round today. It felt easy. I saw the shot and I hit it. I never second guessed. There was no doubt. You know, the club came out of the bag before I even chose it." You know, those are the things that great players say. It's never really too detailed where, you know, I married the path and the face perfectly, or the face was opening a half degree every inch. Guys don't say that.
No, they don't. It just feels right. So what's the next, where's putting going then? Right. So if we have, what's the next evolution? Is it, you know, we've got the green reading stuff. You know, there's been changes there. It seems like there's a new grip every year. There's a hot grip. Yes. And so much trying out. I had a friend telling me left hand low is the best way to putt because it gets your shoulders level, etc. I always putt pretty well left hand low. But I'm not doing that today. But you're also talking more about feel, and maybe the instructional world is sort of, I don't know, are they going to come around to that? What's the next great putting innovation?
Yeah, we're seeing it now, and you would know it, that there's a huge migration right now from what we would call historically a blade putter. You said bullseye, which I started the PGA Tour using a bullseye in 1983 and 1984, we had cavity backed putters, like the ping putters, right, that had a bigger sweet spot. We call those blades still, and now the mallets. I think 72% of the field last week used a mallet of some kind. Scotty Cameron, who's the most prolific putter maker in the world, says, I can't tell you how many mallets I'm getting into play every week. And again, when you look at the measuring of how these putters work, even if you miss the sweet spot slightly, there's less twisting in the face. We use words like moment of inertia. But I think feel is really important. I think a lot of the players, like Rory, he uses a spider mallet with a longer line on the top, and would say that's easier for him to align his short putts. And he almost wishes that he could use a blade for longer putts and maybe in windier conditions, because there's a little bit more feel and feedback. And you're not seeing the greatest players in the world use massive iron club heads, right? They're still small blades, because I think they can hit the sweet spot. They can curve a shot better. There's more variety in what they can do with their shot setups. So I'm just wondering, is this going to be a trend that lasts forever? Because I think it's much harder to go from a mallet back to a blade than it is to go from a blade to a mallet. And these kids nowadays that are watching Rory and so many of the young guys like a Morikawa or a Hovland that are using mallets, maybe that's just the way it's going to be for a while.
Yeah, I tell you, Brad, I go back and forth myself. I'm sure a lot of people do. If you're putting well with the blade, you're like, this is great. But if you're not, then it's, if you're starting to not, if you're not hitting the center, then you think, all right, let me get that mallet back in play, more forgiving. Going to give me a little more roll or whatever on miss hits, particularly. But there's nothing better than when a ball comes rolling off the center of your Newport or whatever, and you just know it's going in when you hit it, which is not generally the feeling that I get from a mallet putter. But what's your take on green reading right now with aim point and all that fun stuff?
So in 2015, when Fox Sports started covering all the USGA events, we assembled a team that included Joe Buck, Greg Norman, Shane Bacon, you mentioned Shane, Julie Inkster was on our team, Curtis Strange. We had a team of, very experienced golfers, not very experienced broadcasters, including myself. But I think we had some good innovations out there. And a lot of the players, the top players in the world on both the LPGA and the PGA Tour, were using aim point. And our producer got so sick of us saying aim point, straddle in line. I forgot to mention Scott McCarron, who was an aim point advocate. He said, we can't say it anymore. Hmm. And I think some of our guys, our team maybe butchered how aim point is supposed to be work. And then the founder, Mark Sweeney, who lives in Orlando, about a couple hours drive from where I live in Palm Beach Gardens, said, hey, can I come see you? And I was intrigued, because I like the system, the idea of this system where you could potentially teach someone a recipe on how to do green reading better, because I think it's the hardest thing to teach a novice, a beginner, an occasional golfer. And I grew up as a caddy, so I learned organically, right? I'm reading a green for a person every day. Early in the mornings when we teed off, I see the ball roll and see that dew mark and the sweeping of the putts. And I have that image every time I hit a putt now, which took a lot of time and a lot of years. So I wanted to see how Mark did this. He's a very nice guy. Showed me how he measures short putts, long putts, how they use the amount of fingers and the distance from the eyes. And I said, wow. And then using your feet to feel percentage of slope. And I'm like, what I wonder is if you're teaching this to, let's call a mid handicap golfer, 12 to 15 handicapper that plays once or twice a week. They have to spend a lot of time learning to do that. And I'm not sure if there's a faster way to teach someone like that. So I liked Aimpoint. You certainly seem to see a lot less tour players doing it. I mean, Keegan Bradley last week, of course, was in there. Adam Scott still does it. But I think it's hard to do it on long putts, double breaking putts. And certainly if you're doing it, there's that chance of stepping on somebody else's line, having it take a lot longer to do it. And again, that's where I just think that, boy, if you can trust your eyes and trust your feet yourself. And I keep loving this idea of practicing hitting putts in at different speeds and not having everything be perfect and learning to read greens a little bit your own way rather than someone else's. And certainly no disrespect to Mark Swing.
Yes. Bravo to that. I agree with you there. And you did bring up a name that I want to mention. Our friend Greg Norman, who you did broadcast with and also played golf with a lot. He was one of your partner. I guess what was it? So now it's the Zurich. What would have been when you were playing the team event?
Arc Shootout?
Yeah. No. Didn't you partner up?
I played with Greg in the Fred Meyer Challenge.
The Fred Meyer Challenge, yeah.
A two-day event Peter Jacobson hosted out in Portland, Oregon. It was a fun event. Silly season event, we would have called it.
Oh, okay.
Arnold and Peter played together a lot, Jacobson. I got paired with Greg a couple times, and for me, it was an honor. Greg helped me to start my international career in Australia, playing in the early 90s to go over there. There was a huge history of some of the best players in the world in that Australian Open, including, you know, Jack Nicklaus, who won the thing three or four times, Gary Player seven times, players like Snead. Everybody went there. Arnold, because it's great, the greatest golf maybe anywhere in the world. And the Stonehaven Cup is a great trophy. So, I mean, I respected Greg. He was number one in the world then. Ian Baker Finch was a close friend. So we got to go down there. I went for, you know, almost, it seemed like every year for 10 years to play there. And when Fox made the play at the USGA's contract in 2014, when it was at Pinehurst, Joe Buck, Greg, and their producer called me in and said, "Hey, look, we'd like," and I was doing some Golf Channel stuff for Live From with Brandel and the team there, Rich Lerner. And they asked me if I'd be interested in being on the team. And I started thinking about it. I said, this is an unbelievable deal. We can cover all the USGA events. I grew up, you know, a big advocate of USGA, learning the game, the rules, the etiquette, you know, formation of my life, really. And so this could be good. So happily joined the team. Greg worked with us that first year, you know, when we opened up at Chambers Bay, and then did all the amateur events. And I think that one thing for Greg, you know, he didn't grow up in America. He didn't play much amateur golf. So maybe it wasn't a perfect fit, but for the USGA to kind of go in, or for Fox to go into the USGA, having that big whale, Greg, a big whale, hadn't really done much broadcasting, but certainly a huge recognizable voice, like everybody in the tower is, you know, whether it's Paul Azinger or Nick Faldo. I think the viewer wants to hear somebody that's got a good history in the game.
Do you have any insight into what he's up what he's after now, or what he's gone after sort of the tour twice, seems to be getting more traction this time around. What any insight into what drives him and what he's trying to accomplish here?
So in 1994, you said this is twice, you said he was running that Shark Shootout, and I was invited. I had played in 93. I got invited to play with Freddie Couples in 94. And Greg was playing with his best friend at the time and number one player in the world, Nick Price. Arm was there. Jack was there. Ray Floyd, Lee Trevino. It was one of the most powerful rooms I've ever been in when Greg basically, it wasn't really an invite to this room prior to the first round of the tournament. It was a kind of a demand. Look, I'm going to have an announcement. So he and his team gave every player in the room a syllabus of this plan for seven World Golf Championship events, four of them prior to the week of a major. And his whole concept is we need the best players in the world playing more often together. No cut, upfront money. Not upfront money, but guaranteed money. And, you know, it was intriguing. He said he had television, said he had a sponsor. We didn't care who those were. And this was at Sherwood Country Club in this beautiful wine room. It was big table. It was crowded. And Arnold Palmer got up to speak. Now, back in 1994, Arnold was still relevant, playing in senior tour golf events and hosting his own big Arnold Palmer Invitational. And Arnold spoke about how the PGA Tour and the PGA of America separated in 1968 with Joe Dye to formulate a plan to go forward. And he was emotional about this. And he said, Greg, if you don't have the approval of the PGA Tour, I can't believe that this would work or should work. And Greg said, okay, thank. And then Jack spoke, thanks. He said, Jack spoke basically repeating what Arnold said. You need to do this in alignment with the PGA Tour. Fincham had just taken over the reins from Beamon. Jack spoke a little bit about how important the PGA Tour was to him. And then Nick Price got up. And Nick was, it was in the streak of winning, I think, three majors and 17 tournaments in about 2 years. And he said, look, Greg, I came from Rhodesia then, and I got out of Rhodesia to try to play golf and left the South African tour to go to Europe. Never thought I could see anything better in my life. And then I came to America and started playing the PGA Tour. And he says, Greg, everything in my life I owe to the PGA Tour. I just can't go on with this. And I'm sitting here in disbelief watching this. And he had a little sheet that you could sign if you were going to agree to play in these events. And everybody kind of walked out of the room. And then, I kid you not, the next morning in the newspaper, the local newspaper up there in that northwest part of LA, he said, the paper said, Greg Norman announces World Tour players unanimously agree.
Whoa.
And I'm like, whoa, yeah, exactly. What room was everybody in that said they agreed? Nobody agreed. And the only name on the sheet that was signed was from Seve Ballesteros and maybe David Frost. And Ballesteros was in Spain. He faxed it in there. And he wouldn't have understood the intricacies of the inner workings of the PGA Tour, nor did Greg Norman, because he never sat on the PGA Tour's policy board or the PAC. So I thought that was interesting. And of course, we all know what happened a few years later. Fincham came up with the PGA Tour's concept for World Golf Championships. And I think ever since then, at best, the relationship of the tour and Greg was frosty. I can't imagine how this whole idea came about with Greg and the Saudi Arabians, except for my guess would be he's doing a lot of golf course design internationally. He does a lot in Asia and Middle East. He's prolific in his golf courses, 50, 60, 70s at some point around. And they said, hey, would you be a spokesman for this idea? So that's kind of how I think it started. And he's said on camera that it's not a vendetta. I find that really hard to believe, because it seems it's only a vendetta. And certainly maybe to put some money in his pocket and other people's pockets.
And Brad, that's incredibly insightful, and taking us to a time and that moment. Wow. You this weekend heard you describing yourself certainly as a PGA loyalist. Talk about that a little bit, where that comes from. PGA Tour loyalist, I would say.
Yes. And obviously being American and growing up here, I'm 60 years old now. So, you know, Arnold Palmer, when I was starting to pay attention to golf, it was the early to mid 70s. Nicholas had kind of taken over the throne from Arnold Palmer, but Arnold Palmer had put golf on the map through the tour. And then as I got older and older and started watching, you know, names like Weisskopf, Trevino, you name it, Watson, Johnny Miller. And those were inspirations to me. And seeing the best players, I think they were the best players in the world, because you'd occasionally see Gary Player sprinkled in there and some of the other international players. Then, of course, the boom in the late 70s, early 80s with Seve, Woosnam, Langer, Lyle, Valdo. started to grow the game slowly internationally, but it was great to see the major championships. And then maybe a couple weeks before each of those bigger events, you'd see the international players come over, and it brought a lot of intrigue. And when the Ryder Cup changed from just GB and I to the whole continent of Europe, they started to dominate. It was remarkable. And I was asked, you know, to come on NBC with Mike Tirico, and just, he asked me about Rory, and then he asked me about this competing league that has endless pockets, right? We know that public investment fund from Saudi Arabia is as big as there is in the world, and it's not even close. But what I said and what I mean, I think that players grow up dreaming of playing in the biggest tournaments against the best competition in the world. And how are those players at the end of time, end of the career, how are you measuring how great a player was? And we've always done it in the past by how many major championships, that was one barometer, how many total wins, did you have international wins? Open championships were always big, like Canadian Open, Australian Open. And then there were other additives that, like Ryder Cups, maybe personal awards, a Payne Stewart Award, a Francis Ouimet Award, Player of the Year Awards. You'd have to go pretty far down before you added money lists. You know, yeah, how many times did you win the season? The Player of the Year Award was certainly something, but I don't think the players, even if today, grew up thinking about, oh, I want to make $100 million like Tiger or Phil or a billionaire. I mean, maybe some of them, and that changes now, especially the way the game's grown so much internationally. But I've told all these players, and I talked to Harold Varner about, look, what do you want to be when you grow up? How do you want to be remembered? And yeah, this money is staggering, you know? And I thought from the lay golf fan, it's kind of cool that, you know, you could have Rory McIlroy, Matt Fitzpatrick, and Scottie Scheffler down the stretch. But this week at the Travelers Championship, Rory's starting at zero with the guy that four spots on Monday, right? You're not in the front of the pack like a qualifying lap at a Formula One race. And if Rory doesn't perform and doesn't finish in the top half of the field, he is not getting paid prize money. I think there's a certain beauty to that. And I understand as we get more ways to consume the game digitally. There's so many ways that players can watch now. It's fabulous. And these top players that, if you're measuring comparatively to other sports, you could make the argument that golfers were underpaid or severely underpaid, depending on the team sports, but it's not an apples to apples. And I think that what LIV Golf, the Saudis, are trying to do is make, come up with a team ownership. And this is ownership, whether they say it or not, where you're going to have to follow and conform to a set of their rules rather than the PGA Tour's rules. And I think what I'm trying to say is, look, if you're a player on the PGA Tour, you have to do a couple of things. And if you want to keep your membership, players know there's a minimum of 15 events that you have to you're required to play. Now, players that aren't in the top 10 or 20 or 30 in the world, they're always fighting for more access so that they can move up that FedEx point list or that money list so they can have more access and get chance to play in bigger purses, more selective purses. World ranking points mean a lot to the players now. And players are now getting compensated, the top players, from something like the Wyndham Points or the Player Impact Program, where someone like Rory, if he goes to the Travelers this week and announces his commitment weeks in advance, they can use his name and likeness. The tour owns that name and likeness. And that's what Phil fought over. That's what Greg has fought over. So they can promote that. And that promotes the tournament that week, golf in particular. It helps Rory that he gets promoted, of course. But if he goes to the tournament, plays a practice round, plays in the Pro-Am, which is an obligation if you want to have money go to your pension, and that's a giant pension, the best in sports. But if Rory happened to play poorly and miss the cut, he doesn't receive any direct prize money for being there that week. And when you think of other sports, and if you look at the Golden State Warriors, the Boston Celtics, there were some players on that bench that didn't play after, you know, if there were seven or eight guys that dominated the amount of time on the floor, those guys still got compensated. They still got bonus money for the team winning the world championship or playing in the finals of the playoffs. So the tour is trying to direct more money to these top guys. And this is the first real challenge the PGA Tour's had. You know, I think they've always been dominant when you look at the other tours around the world. Are there too many tours now? Are there too many subsidiary tours when you look at Korn Ferry, Canadian Tour, Asian Tour, Japanese Tour? I don't know. I think it's good for the game of golf. Is it confusing? Probably. Was Greg Norman right? The players needed to play more often together? Yes, but I still think if you had a limited field of just 40 players, whatever their number is, and they only those 40 played together for a whole year, I don't know. I don't think you can just all of a sudden take this 100-year plus history and change the sport.
Agreed. And there's something, especially talking about the U.S. Open, how exciting was it to have some names in there? It's great to have those top five names, but then a few guys you've never heard of, right? And that's the what makes the U.S. Open such a great tournament. And that's what makes professional golf so interesting sometimes and gives us all hope that we can one week finally play the way we think we're supposed to play, that we can get hot and a player can get hot and do something really remarkable rather than see the same 40 names over and over. And it is interesting, just on the theme of obligations, players thinking the PGA Tour obligations could be onerous. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what the Saudis expect from the golfers for which they've played dearly. I've read some things where when so-and-so calls, you better be there. So we'll see how that plays out.
Right. And here's the kind of dichotomy that I see is, look, the players now that have, I use the word defected, are using terms like independent contractor, self-employed, meaning they can do whatever they want to do. And I haven't heard Greg Norman or a other representative of the LIV Golf tell us what their long range plan is. And if it is 48 event players, if it is 18 events and you have to go to all of those, all of a sudden it's a little different, right? So if your son's got a baseball game or a graduation or it's your wedding anniversary, you know, we could always choose not to go to Yankee Stadium if we didn't like going there. Then you geared your schedule up on the major championships, the tournaments you played particularly well in, maybe world ranking points, cities you like. What if you didn't like a city? What if you said, no, I'm not going there? I there's too many unknowns for me. I don't want to speak uninformed about it. But I have told any player that's asked me, look, the money's going up. In the end of 2025, the FedEx Cup champion is going to make $55 million on the golf course, prize money. That's a lot of money. And maybe it's not as much as some of the top quarterbacks make in the NFL, but it's pretty close. And you can have a long golf career if you're smart and make tons of money off the golf course too. So I think these are really interesting times. And I have to say that this week might be the most important week in the history of the PGA Tour. The policy board meets tomorrow is the official meeting. My guess is they're crammed in some room soon today. I know Monahan's going to be up there. And we need a tremendous amount of support from other players besides Rory, Justin, and John Rahm. We need voices from those in the middle of the pack, like a Harold Varner, like Cameron Tringali, and saying, look, I don't want to go somewhere else. I don't want to be at somebody else's beck and call. And I applaud them for coming out with all this kind of money and trying to do it. I wish it would be in conjunction with the PGA Tour and not trying to put them out of business.
Very interesting week indeed. Yeah, you know, now with the U.S. Open finished, A lot of players who were going to move maybe might feel there might be announcements, there might be stuff coming from the PGA Tour. Very interesting times, as you said. Brad, we can't thank you enough for the time. I just want to end with a question about, you know, I think a theme that runs through this podcast and through your career in broadcasting, after an amazing career in golf and still playing amazing golf, Champions Tour, etc. You are one of golf's great communicators. I love to listen to you talk about golf, putting, golf courses, whatever it is. You're good at it. Not every golfer is. What is it about? And not every person is. A lot of people are, you know, that microphone is pretty scary. Speaking in front of a group of people is pretty terrifying. You seem pretty comfortable in your own skin. Where does that come from?
Upbringing, for sure. The game of golf. My dad was a very good player, scratch golfer, club champ at a couple different places. My grandfather, interestingly enough, spoke at the age of 93 in Boston after George Herbert Walker Bush was given the Ouimet Award. Bush was the first non-professional golfer to get that award. My grandfather in the Depression started caddy camps on Cape Cod at 6 or 7 of the more prominent clubs where kids could go live at those clubs, caddy, make some money. And there's only one or two left. I think they're both on Nantucket.
Yeah, I'm going to visit one in Nantucket this summer. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, so there's one at Sankaty Head and one at Nantucket Golf.
Yeah.
And it's fabulous. And so when I was young, my dad used to drive to the Cape. He had a little tiny cottage there that my sister lives in now. And I would caddy for him and his friends. And we would, it wasn't torture. It was, you know, 10 o'clock tee times. It wasn't 7:30. They would finish and they'd sit on the patio and have a drink and lunch. And I would go play 9 holes by myself. And I think what I liked for them, I mean, the game was competitive to them, but it was also social. I learned golfing vernacular from a bunch of cast of characters that could have been a funny movie, maybe. And, you know, I really felt like golf, you know, formed my life. I don't know if it saved my life. That's probably not the right word. My parents were divorced young in this little town where I lived in. A neighbor of mine said, "Hey, we can go caddy and make money." When I was 12 years old, I stopped my paper route and started riding my bike up to this, the club. And the then professional there, Freddie Bruno, took me under his wing a little bit. He was the hardest working man I've ever seen in my life at the course every day at 5 o'clock, picking range balls by himself at 8 p.m. I'd never seen anything like it. So I think that work ethic, the passion, the fact that everybody from the Acushnet Company Titleist seemed to be a member at my club. I met Wally Uline then. He's like a big brother to me now. And I don't know, it was a perfect place to grow up. We had a good school system. You know, we didn't have perfect weather, so it wasn't an all-around, all-year sport. And if somebody asked me what I would have done if I didn't play golf, I wouldn't be able to answer it because it's impossible, because I've always had it in my life. And it's helped me in so many different ways. I don't regret a thing.
Awesome. Brad, I grew up caddying as well, so some things in common. Also, as you mentioned, Team Titleist in common. And Team Titleist, we are big fans of them here. Before we go, just run us through the facts and wedge, the Vokey grind, to have your own grind. I mean, that's, talk about what people we were mentioning before. What do players play for? Money, immortality. I'd like to have my initial on the bottom of a Vokey wedge. So how does that come about? And what do you love about playing? I love the wedges I have in my bag, and I'm sure you do as well.
Right. I mean, the evolution of Titleist as a golf company, equipment company, it's always a ball first company we know that the number one ball forever. The numbers are staggering, and the percentage of the fields that use Titleist golf balls. I think the vision of Wally Uline coming from a sales rep into the offices and saying, look, we can dominate every equipment category. And now, over the last couple of years, there's no equipment company that can boast saying we've had the most played golf ball, driver, fairway wood, hybrids, like you mentioned, irons, like you mentioned, wedges from Vokey, Scotty Cameron putters. And to be able to have, I don't know, the foresight to go out and say, let's hire these guys and have their name on wedges, have their name, and have them be real people that, you know, the history of Vokey with what he did before he got to Titleist, and the genius of Scotty Cameron, the artistry of that. And I don't know. When that first wedge that had my initials on it had a couple holes drilled out of the back, and then, you know, Vokey, I get to meet Vokey and talk about how clubhead design works, how a leading edge can help, how a bounce can help, changing the size or the look of a club, how you finish it. I never knew that stuff. And now, I mean, there's an entire fitting system for just wedges. And I looked at Matthew Fitzpatrick's bag and, you know, look at the different gaps in his wedges and what's the difference in his bounce angles for those things. And it's even nowadays when you get a putter, you got to get fitted for these things. You can't just pick it off the rack, or I guess you can, but there's a formula for, if you want to be your best, how that can work. So I'm proud to be a Titleist guy. I know Scotty Cameron advertises with Golf Journal, and I have always something with me.
There it is.
When I'm traveling, right?
There he is. Guys, the Golfer's Journal.
Yep.
You guys number 20. Job. Thank you. What a handsome cover it is. Glad to see it in your hands. And yes, don't leave home without it when you're traveling. The best on-flight read, or anywhere read, we hope.
I loved the Gorgeous George article. He was a big character in my life when I first got out there. And he was a New Englander and played up here in mini tours and stuff. So that was fabulous.
Awesome. We're so, that's so wonderful to hear. And thank you again for your time. And yes, let me thank you. Let me thank our listeners, our subscribers, and the brands that support the Golfer's Journal. They are Titleist, Link Soul, FootJoy, Oakley, Links and Kings, Scotty Cameron, and Charles Schwab. Brad, you're the best. And we wish you continued success. Hopefully see you. Hey, we'll see you up at Rhode Island Country Club, all right?
Let's do it. I respect what you guys are doing. Keep up the great work, Tom.
Thank you so much. Thank you.